This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations, on the web at violetusa.com, and by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource, a reference for broadcast engineers with new reading each week, on the web at thebdr.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
His first contact with 5 watts from Newburgh, New York, was Hawaii, through the flagpole.
Wow.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
I have all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
Along with Chris Tobin, Tom Ray, Chris Tarr, and the best part, you're here.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi, welcome in. Glad you're here. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and along with me, we have a few other hosts on the show. We've got a great show for you in store. I'm really excited about this one because we're going to speak our minds about a few things and share some info about radio and amateur radio on the show today. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at Telos Omni and Axia. That's my day job. And get to do this show once a week and talk to you and to these four other hosts. So let's move right now to the Hudson Valley, New York, where Tom Ray is standing by in his ham shack. Hi, Tom.
Greetings, Kirk, and how are you today?
I'm great. I'm great. You work for the folks at Buckley Broadcasting, right?
I sure do. Work out of WOR in New York City and live up here about 50 miles north of New York City in the Hudson Valley. And it's been rather warm out here, so I'm sitting here in my Comrex Hawaiian shirt.
That's a good.
We've been having some video issues with Kirk with his internet connection.
That's because it's not Friday, so it's not Hawaiian shirt day. That's why.
You should have told me, guys. Come on. But I'm sure Kirk will be right back. He was telling us right before we went to air that they had a major power failure in Nashville yesterday, where Kirk is, and ever since then, the internet connection has been dropping packets. So I don't know, maybe they have some damage at one of their repeater points or whatever. But anyway, I'm Tom Ray, like you said, and I work for Buckley Broadcasting, WOR in New York, and also here in New York, this time down in the city, we go over to Chris Tobin. Chris, good evening.
Good evening, Tom. Good evening, Chris Tarr. And Kirk, if you do hear us, good evening to you. Yes, I'm gainfully employed by the folks at CBS Radio, and we have 6 radio stations here in New York City, 3 AMs and 3 FMs. We nice equal opportunity for a disaster or fun. Very hot. I say it's very hot here in the city, in the lower state or downstate from where you are, Tom. So it's. I don't have an Hawaiian shirt today, though. I think I have to try that for the next broadcast.
Oh, you should. We ought to have a Hawaiian shirt broadcast. I think it'd be a lot of fun, and it'd be quite the hoot. and if we take a little trip out to the Midwest, we'll go out and see Chris Tarr. Chris, good evening.
Hello there. I've got a shirt just like that, actually. I wish I would have known you were going to wear it. I would have put mine on. I have it back in the closet here. I am Chris Tarr. Work for Intercom in Milwaukee and Madison, and I am in charge of, 5 FM radio stations and 1 AM radio station. And as a lot of you have heard, we've had some pretty bad weather in the Midwest the past couple of days. I'm pretty tired. I spent a lot of late nights the past couple of days dealing with transmitters on generators and computers not being happy after getting fried and things like that. So I'm looking forward to a little break here with Twert tonight.
It's possible that I might be back. So am I?
Ooh, I hear Kirk. There he is.
And I know Chris Tarr has been working late. I see his Foursquare updates like at 2 in the morning, you know, waiting for the power to come back on, waiting for pizza.
Yeah, well, there's this great diner. They call it George Webb, and they're all over Milwaukee, and they're open 24 hours. It's great, kind of a almost like a Waffle House, Kirk. And so what we, you know, what I've been doing is power goes out, I've got nothing to do, so I just go sit over at George Webb with my coffee while the generator's running, you know, waiting for the power to come back up so I can go turn servers back on and things. So
I think we lost Kirk. Hello, I'm back. I'm here. And it looked like we were about to lose Chris Tarr, too, because Chris was occasionally freeze-framing, but the audio was good. Anyway, as Kirk said, we have a show tonight that is it's kind of a mishmash and a potpourri and all over the place. And one of the things on Kirk's list of things we could talk about, he mentioned the Amateur Radio Field Day, and we'll chat about that a little later on. But one of the things he said, yeah, we probably ought to touch base on tonight is the SBE's letter to the Federal Communications Commission. Apparently, the FCC wants to have an engineering day to discuss. Right. Yeah, exactly. Without the Society of Broadcast Engineers, the only group that represents broadcast engineers. And my personal opinion is the SBE was right on the money, making a heck of a lot of noise about it, because I don't quite know what the agenda is lately with the FCC with certain things, but at the Ham Radio Club meeting we had the other night, one of our members came up to me and he says, you know, I've been kind of watching this thing with the commission and what they look like they're doing. It's kind of like here in New York, there's a law that if you're a property owner and let's say I've got a piece of property here and it's 50 feet long and maybe I've got 10 feet or so, for whatever reason, I don't mow it, but my neighbor comes over and mows it. And this goes on for 10 or 12 years, and then I finally sell the house. Well, that neighbor actually could claim and annex that 10-foot-wide piece of property that he's been mowing because he has been maintaining it. And he says, you know, that it looks like that's what the commission's kind of doing lately. You know, they come in and they say, and this guy used to work in television. He says, you know, they came in and they said, okay, we want channels 70 through 83 for cellular. And yeah, okay, but well, all you guys who had translators up here, move them down. You know, along came DTV, and they took another portion of the spectrum, and gosh knows what else they're looking to do for the new wireless communications and to get more bandwidth. So, I don't know, Chris Tobin, I guess you're still with us. what do you think about this?
Unfortunately, my gut feeling tells me, and it's been going on for some time, but I think it's starting to accelerate. If you've got cash in hand and you come to the commission, you could probably lobby for what you think is best in your interest and what gives the coffers at the U.S. Treasury some more cash. Because if you really read into some of the stuff that's going on with the commission and the rulings they're choosing to enforce or create, they go counter to pretty much the basic principles behind the Communications Act of 1934, the revisited Communications Act of, 2006. It just doesn't add up. And broadcasters, land mobile operators, you know, two-way radios, if you will, even the cable industry, but they've got very good lobbyists. They're mowing the lawn. They're just literally coming in and saying, hey, you know what? It's nice you've been here for 35, 40, 50 years, but we've got something more apropos, more, you know, efficient. It's better for the consumer, the public interest, because it's cellular, because it's broadband. That's what I see going on. I mean, it's my opinion, of course, but I don't believe it's being done in the best interest for everyone, because as we know, as broadcasters, we have probably the best transmission medium you could use. Single point to many people, and the bandwidth is constant and works, and we can do a lot with it. Cable, subsidized monopolies. Yes, that's true. They are subsidized monopolies if you read into a lot of what goes on. The television industry is getting trampled by people, and NAB is really not doing much, nor the broadcasters themselves. And cellular industry, well, you only have, what, three players that really control stuff. I don't see much going on in the field, even playing field. So, and then the fact that the engineering community is left out of a major meeting with the FCC, it pretty much clearly says, hey, the A students shouldn't be allowed into the meeting with the B students because we know what they're going to say to us, and we don't know how to defend ourselves because that means we lose money. Again, just my
opinion.
You know,
Chris, that's an interesting way to put it, and I'm glad you put it that way because I think you're right. I mean, even just from the radio standpoint, you take a look at what we've been dealing with, over the last 20 years with losing some spaces in the RPU bands and the overcrowding in the STL band. And every time we go to the commission and say, guys, help, they say, no, you got enough. You got enough.
You know, it's interesting to see, you know, the FCC is supposedly all about the consumers, and a lot of these rulings are supposed to be better for the consumers. Yet, you know, we're looking at even something as basic as net neutrality, where they're trying to run basically internet providing as a common carrier service, which, you know, at least gives them regulation to enforce some of these consumer, you know, these reforms that are good for the consumers in terms of network neutrality. And they're having these closed door meetings with AT&T and Verizon and all these providers, and not really releasing any of the information of what's going on there in the wake of these upcoming hearings and things. And so, you know, there's a lot of that stuff, even not directly related to broadcast, that really has been kind of something we haven't really seen from the FCC, and I don't think it's what we were expecting from the current FCC administration. I think we all thought that things were going to go a little bit our way with Jenikowski, but it really hasn't gone that way.
No, and you're right. And as a matter of fact, Kirk just shot me a note. He says, I'm posting the link to the open letter to the FCC on the site. And, Kirk, are you still with us?
Not really, sort of barely. So you guys can probably just carry on.
anything you wanted to add? Because we'd like to hear from you.
No, I was reading over the letter, and it's it is very interesting how the SBE was not invited. And I agree very much with Chris Tobin's comments. So you guys carry on if you would, because I'm afraid that my Comcast is just not Comcasting today. We'll see if we can have it fixed. But you know what? Next, by the way, I'll put in a little show note here. Next week, I'm going to try to be doing the show with you from Riga, Latvia, where they actually do have good internet. It'll be 3 o'clock in the morning for me, but we'll try to get it done from there. But today, Nashville, Tennessee, it's not Comcasting. So we'll see if we can get them out here and get it fixed.
Cool. Anyway, Kirk, there were a couple other things on your list, and unfortunately I don't have it in front of me. Can you run those by?
I do. I've got it right here in front of me. We were going to talk about that, plus the I wanted to talk about that just in terms of what the mazes have meant to radio in terms of consolidation and how that's affected engineering, for good or for bad. In some ways it's been good, and in some ways it's been bad. I thought you guys might want to chip in on that.
Well, Chris Tobin, you want to take that one to start?
Oh, it's Mark Mays and the Clear Channel folks? Sure. You know, I have to say, I read through that article, the letter that went out, and there are some positives to what Clear Channel has done. The thought of consolidation, as we know it, didn't start just with the Mays family. It started before then with other operators. It just, I think, the Mays family somehow found the wherewithal to bring it together and perpetuate and short of trying to rule the world, which they've been quoted as saying they wanted to do in part of their development. They consolidated larger groups or smaller medium groups to a larger size, and we have Clear Channel today. Consolidation on the whole, I think, still has its issues. It works in some markets and some business models, but I don't think it works in all. I think if you just strictly look to consolidate operations or radio stations or even TV, just for the sake of the Wall Street quarterly share, profit share, whatever you want to call it, the stock price, you'll doom yourself to failure. I think the Mays family found that out, but it was too late to do anything. The snowball had begun down the hill, and you know, now they're private, which pretty much says itself that doing what they did was nice. At the time, it was the drunken sailor routine. The party was going on, the lights were out, and everybody was just going for it. And then the lights came on, and suddenly, oh, wow, maybe this isn't what we should be doing. Right?
No, I agree, Chris. It's consolidation's been it's been an interesting ride the last 10 years. Chris Tarr, you have any comments on that?
Well, you know, the one thing that the Mays has tried to do with Clear Channel was this kind of math where 2 + 2 = 5. And in some cases, yes, that worked. And, you know, in some cases, it really didn't. And I know that Kirk posted a note here, which I was going to talk about, is that where it really helped were in the smaller markets where you've got, you know, the smaller single 1 or 2 AM-FM combo type of things. And in those situations, I think the power of having that large market or, you know, the large buying power and things improved the engineering in those smaller markets. You're talking about stations with operators who really couldn't afford to upgrade equipment. And then with Clear Channel, I know some of their policies are, as their larger markets get new equipment, their older stuff is retired down the line. But, you know, old is a relative term with broadcast equipment. So I think, you know, just some of their standards and practices and the way they've handled their engineering departments, I think has been good in those smaller markets. I think the one issue that they've run into, though, is you can only cut so much. And then you get to the point of diminishing returns after that, where you've made your cuts and, you know, now you're really saving some dough compared to what you had before, but you can only do that so long before all of a sudden things get overlooked, things fall through the cracks. And I think in some places they you know, got to that point, and I think are coming back a little bit. But in terms of consolidation, I think it had to happen. You know, it gets a bad rap, and in some cases for good reason. But, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, investing in a radio station is kind of like investing in a CD, you know, in terms of rate of return. You know, if you get anything out of it, it's razor thin. And, you know, nowadays, unless, you know, you've got a niche formatted station in a small area, it's very hard to make money if you're not part of a larger group that could kind of, you know, share and kind of, you know, spread talent around a little bit.
And, you know, it's kind of interesting with the consolidation to take a look at, especially when the economy soured, to see what happened. It's funny. I've got a couple of friends work in much smaller markets, significantly smaller markets than New York, and they tended not to have any major issues money-wise up until things started turning around. We're in the cities. I mean, we were just, you don't want to say sucking wind, but we were sucking wind because there was really no place for us to turn. And I just saw a note come in from Kirk. Kirk said his internet's horrible and he's not going to be joining us back, which is unfortunate because Kirk adds a lot to the show. But, yeah, we told him we'd carry on. And unless we want to do something else on consolidation, I would agree, though. You know, a lot of ways it's good. In some ways, yeah, maybe not so good when you got one guy running around with eight radio stations trying to maintain everything. When one thing fails or two or three stations fail at once, what do you do when you're the only guy? That's something I think about.
Well, consolidation, though, I think people went a little too far. I think that I believe, because I worked for two broadcast companies who decided to use consolidation as a means to say they were making money by cutting expenses but not really introducing new revenue to the bottom line. So I think part of the consolidation issue, where Chris is right, it's well-deserved in many places and makes sense to do, and it was a method of business or business method that nobody really thought about. But I think some folks went too far and said, oh, we can consolidate, we can reduce the duplication of resources or assets, which was the line I got from a lot of folks. But the problem was they reduced their assets in areas that cost them. But because the current general practice for accounting for the monies, the resource management wasn't in place, you couldn't see it until about 6 months, a year later, when all of a sudden you're reviewing your bottom line and going, wow, we are not cutting the mustard. And that's what's happened. I think, and cutting it to the bone too far. And now all of a sudden people are reverting back to what they believe to be a better practice. And they're making it as if, you know, Clear Channel was the evil side of the thing, when in reality was all they did was say, hey, here's a new way of doing business if you choose, and everyone went to the extreme. I could be wrong, but looking at some places that I've worked at and people I've talked to, and the way resources or assets were being managed, 9 times out of 10, the department that had 12 people, they reduced it to half and then reduced it to a third of that and said, well, we're doing great. They cut back on everything they did external to the radio station. So I don't know. I think it's a good thing. The Mays are stepping back. The new investors, it's private. The company's going to look to do something. And maybe people will start to realize there's more to radio than just simply, you know, cut back on expenses and say, yeah, we made money this month. And that's what a lot of people have been doing. If you read annual reports, you see it.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And it's, like I said, it's been an interesting ride. Well, I was watching some of the notes go back and forth between Twit Engineering and Kirk Harnack. They're pretty funny, but one of the topics we wanted to talk about tonight, and here in New York City, we found it over the last several days. It got real hot in a real hurry, and boy, let me tell you, I stopped at the transmitter site this morning, and it was real humid out there in the swamp. And maybe
what do you expect? It was humid in the swamp. Yeah.
Well, exactly.
It's a swamp. What do you want? Come on, man. It's a swamp. But
Kirk says, you know, what are we dealing with out here? Well, a couple things I've been dealing with the last, I had two things I was dealing with today, but one thing I've been dealing with at WOR over the last 2 weeks, we had an issue with our sample system. That turned out to be the one of the toroids in the sample system, and the new one just arrived today, so we're going to put it in Friday. But with the extra humidity and the extra heat, all of a sudden it's showing us way out of tolerance when we're really not. And interestingly, I got a call from one of our AMs in Hartford today, the Hartford area, that they were having all kinds of issues on their nighttime common point, their single-stick day and directional night, and they faxed me a copy of the schematic. I took a look at it, and there's not a heck of a lot in the schematic of the phaser. And I said, no, it's got to be one of these two capacitors. And sure as heck, they found it. But, you know, things like capacitors pop and toroids go bad and then things really go out of tolerance when it gets really hot and humid. Chris Tarr, what have you seen out there in the Midwest, and what do you generally do to prepare, and what kind of issues have you been having with the heat or that you expect to have?
Oh, where do I begin? Well, you know, the first thing you got to remember when you're cooling these things is that it's not necessarily, you know, people talk about air conditioning or not air conditioning. Really, air conditioning isn't as important. It's the movement of air through the building. And, you know, a couple people here joking on the IRC channel about, Wisconsin in the summer with mosquitoes as big as cats. Yes, you've got that, too. it's always a challenge because obviously the warmer the warmer components get, the more prone to failure they are, you'll have or they'll be. And they also change values and things. So you get some real wild things happening. A very common thing to happen if the transmitter room gets too hot is you'll start to hear squealing in the audio as caps heave up, either in STLs or exciters or things like that. So, you know, one of the most important things you can do is the design of the transmitter building to make sure you're moving just a whole ton of air. In fact, one of my sites in Milwaukee doesn't have air conditioning. It's actually close to Lake Michigan, so the air's naturally cool. But we have these big, big blowers that just move huge amounts of air through the building. And it keeps the transmitters happy. Especially modern equipment now with MOSFETs and those sorts of things, they don't like to get too hot. And they start to really change characteristic when they do. So you need to be careful about that.
Hey, Chris, I think my internet connection may be hanging on here for a little while. I got a couple questions for you about airflow. And first, sure. For the audience, I want to discuss a couple issues about this. It just so happens that the very first article I ever wrote for a professional journal, it was for Broadcast Engineering Magazine, was about airflow in transmitter sites. And I didn't have a lot of math to back me up. I just had a lot of hands-on experience with different airflow schemes in transmitter buildings. I got to answer the question, why do we need airflow? Why do we need what do we need this for in a transmitter building? If you've got a high-power transmitter site where you've likely got a tube-type transmitter generating a lot of heat and needing to blow a lot of air through it, past the tube to keep it cool, then that air is generally exhausted to the outside, and an exactly equal volume of air must enter the building to replenish the air that gets blown outside, the hot air that gets blown outside. Typically, that hot air is 130, 140, 160, 180 degrees, depending on the design of the transmitter, how much is flowing, and if you've got it tuned right, which, by the way, it is possible to tune a transmitter, keeping the power output equal for the lowest temperature, and that often results in the highest efficiency, as you might imagine. So we got to have air come in, and the smart way to do that is to actually force air in through air filters, and the best way to do that is low velocity at high volume, and that means a lot of air filter square footage so that we're blowing air at a low velocity so the air filters have a chance to catch what's in there. And the reason for blowing the air in instead of just letting it come in willy-nilly is so we can keep a positive pressure on the building. And if we have a positive pressure on the inside of the building blowing air into it that's filtered, that means that no unfiltered air will enter the building if the building is positively pressurized. The only air that comes in is the air that we intend to come in. So I think I've covered that subject just a bit, but Chris, let me add, Chris Tarr, this transmitter building you have that's unair-conditioned, is it a positive pressure building, or does the building, the air just come back in however it wants?
No, we don't use positive pressure. We actually draw air out of the building. But what I've found and what we use, which are great, these filters are made by FAR, and they're expensive, F-A-R-R, but you can get these just huge, really deep pleated filters that, when it comes to filters, and the way that these filters work, all of those deep pleats are all surface that air can come in. So you really, you've got a lot of places for air to come in and get that filtering done. So we have filtering on the intake in the building, in the air vent, and then, of course, the filters in the transmitter. But then we use frequency drive motors so that we can adjust the speed of the air that we need depending on the temperature of the building. You know, we always have air moving through the building. And the one thing I would like to add, too, is it not just tube transmitters, now with HD transmitters, too, because of the low efficiency of them, a lot of heat comes out of those as well. So even with the tube transmitters kind of going by the wayside and you've got the, the new solid-state transmitters coming in, you still are very concerned about the volume of air that goes through. And, what you want to do is you want to be able to draw that air through the transmitter to exchange that hot air. And so that requires a lot of air coming through. And the way I have it, at my sites, is I have the where the air comes into the front of the building. Then I have the hoods over the transmitters, and then the frequency drive blowers taking the air that's coming out of the transmitters and just exhausting them. And in the process of that, because the air has to come in through the transmitters in the back of the room, it actually naturally draws air across all of the equipment and across the room, and then out through the transmitter and out through the venting in the ceiling. So it actually keeps it fairly cool. And by fairly cool, you know, it gets up into the 80s and the low 90s, but you know, that's not too bad for broadcast equipment. It's clean air. So, you know, again, with that equipment, as long as that air is exchanging, generally the equipment stays happy.
I take it this is at a site that is not, say, in the middle of a bean field or someplace where the earth is tilled twice a year.
And that's where, you know, and we were mentioning positive pressure. You would absolutely do positive pressure in situations like that where you have, you know, real fine dust all over the place. You know, where you just know that this, you know, this air is going to come in, or the dirt's going to come in through cracks and crevices and things like that. You know, this is in the city. It's not, you know, in any kind of field or anything. It's in a parking lot. So we're not as concerned in that situation with dirt getting in. Same with, you know, the other site that we have that does have air conditioning. Again, it's in a residential neighborhood, not in a field. So the air that does get drawn into the building really isn't dirty.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, another way to do this, keep a building cool, is to air condition all the air. All the air that comes out of the transmitter comes right back into the room and is air conditioned, usually by a main and a backup air conditioner. Because if one dies, you sure want the other one to take over. Or you might have a system that would open louvers and blow the hot air outside should an air conditioner fail. But I have engineered for a few sites that had either one big air conditioner and an emergency louver system to get the hot air out, or had two air conditioners, and we would tend to alternate the thermostat settings on the two air conditioners so that, you know, 1 week one of them worked really hard and the other week the other one would work really hard.
I would say it like that. We use the lead lag, so we'll have two units on there, and then they just generally, one will come up, and when that cycle's done, the next one comes up.
Oh, you can do that. Okay. What kind of equipment do you use to make that happen? Yes, the when one
it's
is,
actually it's a system, and I'm trying to, off the top of my head, I think it's Bard that makes it, and it just has one controller, but it has the two identical units, and the controller itself is what cycles the units on and off. So the way the system works is it'll have, you know, have one on for a cycle, then that'll shut off, then the next cycle the second one comes on, and if one of them faults, then the good one will continue to run.
Now, we could talk for a long time about the big picture of whether you spend the money to air condition a transmitter site or whether you use natural airflow. Now, if, for example, if you're in Mississippi and you use natural airflow, I promise you that the electronics in the transmitters is going to be over 100 degrees. So you're going to have 95, 98 degree days from time to time, and the equipment is going to be just too hot to touch or keep your hand on very long, no matter how much air you blow through there. So the decision is, well, gee, if we air condition this air, if we keep the place cool, the components will last longer, especially things like electrolytic capacitors. Some people have said, you know, for every 10 degree C rise in the ambient temperature where an electrolytic capacitor is, you're going to cut the life of the capacitor in half approximately. So you can see that if you've got a building that you're operating, you're keeping at 70 degrees, well, that may be a real design temp for the equipment. If you've got it at 90 degrees, well, you're 20 degrees Fahrenheit higher there. And if the equipment really inside its own cabinet is running at 110 degrees, which it might very well be if it's 95 in the building, then you've got a recipe for shorter equipment life, but you're saving all the money on the air conditioning. So which is the better way to do?
The other thing you have to worry about in climates like yours, where you go down south, is humidity. And if you don't condition the air, you're drawing in all that humid air, which also causes condensation on the inside of the transmitter and on the components and things, and that can also cause failures.
Well, yeah, also, like in the area where Chris and I have our transmitters in New York City, we're down in the swamp, so it's very humid. But also, the water that's in that swamp tends to be brackish because it's a combination of fresh and salt coming in from New York Harbor.
Oh yeah,
and boy, let me tell you, that wreaks havoc on on stuff if you're sucking that that kind of air through the building. So I think that kind of has to add into the equation too. And additionally, if you're going to air condition the building full time, I mean, that air is going to be, it's essentially a closed environment. You're not bringing any crud in from the outside. And the equipment's going to, it's going to be cleaner. It's going to last longer. You're not going to have that blanket of dirt that typically gets on things, especially with high voltage.
Yeah, yeah. Do any of you have a transmitter site where you ran it for some period of time as a fresh air system, not air conditioned, and then you converted it to a fully air conditioned system? And if so, did you see a change? I had one site that we did that. So any of you guys got?
I did.
Go ahead.
And in fact, I did it in response to a failure with the fresh air system a couple of years ago, where we had it had gone on literally probably the station's been there for 40, 50 years, and it generally ran pretty well. And then about three summers ago, we had a huge heat wave, and inside of the building, the temperature got up above 100 degrees, and the transmitter was a Continental, I don't know, once again, forgetting the model number, but it's a 21 kilowatt Continental. At any rate, the heat damaged it. It failed. And some of the components in the inside failed, some of the caps failed. It was fairly catastrophic. And as soon as we got everything put back together, that's when we put in the air conditioning unit. And here we go. My assistant, Tony's actually just sent me the information. 816R2B. Thank you.
Continental
816R2B. It overheated. It failed. And it was because of the ambient air temperature and the exhaust. I believe at the time was almost 200 degrees coming out of the transmitter. So in response to that, we put in air conditioning, and the transmitter tube life has been better. The transmitters had less failures, and generally the other equipment in the building too has had been a lot easier to maintain with all that heat.
I got to engineer for a station in Memphis, Tennessee, that was a new 50 kilowatt AM. It was WCRV on 640, huge coverage area. And they wanted at first to try running without an air conditioner. The transmitter was a big solid state Nautel 50 kilowatt. And we blew a lot of air through that building and through nice air filters and kept them very clean. And, you know, you could always find the little fine dusting of powder on all the components. We'd take the Nautel transmitter completely apart once a year and dust everything off and make it really clean. But we still had a failure. In the output network, there's just a whole bank of the doorknob mica capacitors, the big black capacitors, and they caught on fire. And it was at a point in the transmitter where Visor metering wasn't effective, because the Visor metering was after this. So the transmitter ran and ran and ran and sustained the fire quite nicely. Luckily, it didn't catch anything else in the building on fire, but they were all burned. So after about 4 or 5 days of cleaning and rebuilding and, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 worth of capacitors, put it all back together, and we bought some air conditioning. And the air conditioning has, as far as I know, worked there quite well for quite some time.
Kirk, we're talking about positive pressure buildings. I did some contract work at a station once. It was 50 kilowatts day, 1 kilowatt night. Talk about a power cutback. And the owner of the station, he had a small kilowatt station daytimer beforehand, so he built the transmitter building and didn't quite build it for the MW50 that was in there. The MW50 had this great hood that went up, and it went up to an exhaust and had an exhaust fan above it that was, you know, went out through the top of the building, which was really great. And then the air intake on the building was about this big.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. Let me tell you, in the summertime when the fans were going and that MW50 was on, and for whatever reason the door opened out, you literally had to put your foot up against the door, grab the doorknob, and pull with all your might, because you could not get in the building unless you shut
the 50K off. Because of the negative pressure in the building. The exhaust fans were blowing so much out with such a restriction of what could come in. Wow.
And let me tell you, there were some spectacular failures in that transmitter. It was unbelievable. Some stupid stuff I've never seen before, and it was like, oh my God. All I can figure is it had to be because of that negative air pressure in the building.
Sure.
We do up north, especially with that air from the transmitter, at the same site that we put the air conditioning in, at one time had an apartment on the other side for the caretaker. And we just put in a venting system where during the winter, instead of venting the air outside, it would suck the air and blow it into the apartment along with a thermostat. And so the guy heated the apartment for free the entire winter. And we do that in our transmitter buildings too, where, you know, I have a switch where I can vent the air back into the room if, you know, in the colder weather, where it gets down, you know, 20, 15 degrees or whatever, I can just vent the heat back into the building to keep it warm.
You know, what's really cold, though, is on a cold overnight when you have the transmitter off and it's 4 degrees below zero outside and the transmitter's off. So
yeah,
you're
that
not getting
so
heat
much
from the while you're working on it. That sucks. somebody in the chat room, Bogo, actually asked, why don't we just use water cooling? That sounds like a good way to get it done. And I know a lot of TV transmitters are water cooled. Guys, why aren't radio transmitters typically water cooled?
Probably
I've been told it's economies of scale. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Chris. Go ahead.
I was told on many occasions it's economies of scale for the cost of doing it, the amount of power the heat transfer ratios that are involved. I mean, it's easily done. You could do it with a CPU on a computer these days, but I guess it's just a practice no one's ever really investigated doing.
I think the plumbing is definitely more expensive for water cooling. Also, the tube would have to be designed for water cooling.
Yeah.
And typically, the types of tubes that we use in radio transmitters are not designed to be water cooled. They could be, and there have been a few that have been, but the typical ones are not. And I do think it's a matter of cost. You buy a TV transmitter, and you might be looking at $200,000 plus for the TV transmitter, maybe, well, $500,000 for some. But radio transmitters, you're often looking at $20,000 to $70,000 for the radio transmitter. And I think that money it's a lot cheaper to put a blower, to put a Granger or a Dayton blower in there and blow a bunch of air past the tube. And that's probably why it is. Now, speaking of water cooling, though, I was at a site in Arkansas that had a really interesting building cooling system. They had a well, and they would pump water up and run it through a heat exchanger. And it's a geothermal sink there, and that kept the building pretty cool. It kept them from having to use the air conditioner very much. Tom, was there something you're going to add there about water cooling?
Oh, no, I was going to say, with water cooling, typically in the TV transmitters, you see those in the UHF transmitters that use klystrons, because most video amplifiers have to run fairly linear, and you know, when you're talking a UHF television transmitter that's pumping out 220 kilowatts and you're talking 20-25% efficiency on the video amplifier, it's a lot more efficient to use water cooling in that case. But you're right. And the stuff we use, the tubes aren't designed, and we're not pumping that kind of waste heat out. Even with the HD transmitters, we're just not pumping that kind of waste heat out to go through the expense of the heat exchangers and the pumps and the expense of running the pumps and having to kind of keep a plumber on staff to keep it cold.
I tell you, I have been at TV stations where they suffered a freeze-up of the cooling system. Of course, the cooling system is inside. It goes through parts of the transmitter. And by the way, the transmitters, generally, they still have some airflow going through them, right? Because there are other things that make heat that are not where that heat is not carried away by the water, because the water jacket is in the tube area where most of the heat is being made. So you got the water, and it then has to go outside to a heat exchanger, and all that's exposed to the weather and elements. So, you know, things like freezing temperatures. It's supposed to have ethylene glycol in it to keep it from freezing, but, you know, not maintenance isn't always perfect. So I have seen TV transmitter sites where there's ice everywhere from ethylene glycol leaking or the water leaking and icing all up.
That must be spectacular when that happens, when the somebody tries to bring the transmitter on first thing in the morning. Oh my gosh, can you imagine?
No. So the business of keeping transmitters cool, if you look at all these transmitter sites where you are consuming less power, for example, look at all the cellular base station sites all across the country, and you look at them and they have what, two air conditioners hanging on the side of the prefab building. The heat load inside the building makes it possible to economical to run air conditioning, and you sure wouldn't want to have, you know, all that equipment just with airflow going through it unless that air was really, really nice. So in some in a lot of cases, I think it's going to cost you more money to make ambient air, you know, to make air from the outside nice enough as opposed to just putting air conditioners on the building. Does that make some sense?
Absolutely.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Hey, at the Empire State Building for you New York engineers, how are transmitters cooled there, whether they're TV or FM transmitters? I think the transmitters that I've seen at Empire State, and I ask about Empire State because you're in a confined environment. You don't have a lot of space in the Empire State Building because real estate's expensive up there. And the ones I've seen, the FMs, were air-cooled with sometimes the plumbing is done such that the air that's going through the transmitter does come from the outside, but the whole build, the whole room itself is not flooded with air. You can duct the air that the transmitter needs directly to the transmitter's own intake, and then the exhaust air can go on to the outside. Hey, Chris Tobin, you back with us?
I am back with you. I don't know what took place there, but it was interesting. I guess the Skype network is having trouble.
So what are the cooling schemes at the Empire State Building?
Cooling schemes at the Empire State Building. Let's see. For the radio folks, it's traditional air conditioning. Try to positively pressurize the room. Because of height, location in the city, the soot from below reaches up high, and you don't want to use any fresh air cooling there. It's not the best thing to do. Television folks, the water cooling, typically a glycol combination. They too, everything is closed room. There's no, I'm not aware of any fresh air cooling taking place. And it's difficult up there too because it's small quarters. The real estate is tiny, and it makes for an interesting time. But everybody does exhaust out to the outside if necessary. If the air conditioning fails, that's the Hail Mary pass. Two stages of cooling, two sets of machines, and then outside if it is for the last resort.
Here's a little point of trivia about the Empire State Building. I got to visit the Z100 transmitter room some years ago.
Did you get to experience George Marshall?
No. This was this was when Rob Muser was the engineer at Z100.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so Rob gave me a tour of the Z100 transmitter room. Transmitter in there was fairly new. I think it was a BE, broadcast electronics transmitter, but there was a backup generator, a power generator, in the room also.
And that's course, typical of an Empire.
You have to get fuel to this thing, right? Well, you know, they don't just let you pipe diesel fuel up, you know, 80 or 90 stories, do they? And for some reason, they couldn't be on natural gas either. So they to get diesel fuel to the backup generator at Z100 in New York, they bring it up by hand in 5-gallon buckets.
Oh, yeah. We do that at the WR studios with the generator on the roof. We can bring it up in the elevator up to the 21st floor. But the next three flights, it's hump it up.
Three flights, 5 gallons. Do you carry a 5-gallon in each hand?
I don't know.
Oh, you have the intern. Bob, the intern, does that, right?
Well, that's why would you have interns? Why not?
Gary, oh, gee. Well, so that was interesting. And of course, the diesel generator itself, its exhaust just, you know, goes out a hole in the wall to the outside. And then that its air intake comes in from a different wall to keep the exhaust and the air intake separate. Chris Tobin, what do you guys do for backup power at Empire?
We have actually only one station has a generator. Reason we did that is we prefer to just have an off-site backup. Empire State Building is a hard target location, known to be bomb scares on a regular basis. So even if we had generators running, odds are we wouldn't be able to maintain certain facilities because they'll get shut down due to the situation involved. So we've spent our time and energy building off-site off-site backups that can give us C-grade signal.
Yeah, like four times square, yeah.
Four times square or transmit sites at the AM stations or other building tops that we can have access to that give us what we need for coverage. But we do have one of the stations with backup power, and it's natural gas. It works. But again, you got to look at the location, and it's best that we don't use that building for everything in an emergency.
Hey, Chris Tarr, we were talking about summertime engineering and things that you have to do to keep radio stations operating in the summertime. And yeah, we're focused mostly on transmitter sites since they tend to be remote and tend to have, people aren't living there typically. So we typically don't have systems there that are intended to, keep people comfortable. We have to keep the transmitter comfortable, but it's not a person. I was curious, do you find you have more trouble with systems in general in the summertime when it's hot or in the wintertime when it's freezing cold? Chris, Tar?
Absolutely summer. I really don't recall ever having a time. Actually, I take that back. There is one. In fact, it was this past year in Sturgeon Bay with the Messix radio station up in Door County, where it was off the air because of a power failure for almost 24 hours, and it was cold, and the building has no heat because it uses the transitor for heat. Well, it came back on, and it actually, you know, it came back up fairly well and ran for almost a day or two, and then had a module fail, and we surmised that it was just, you know, it just failed because of the, you know, going from cold to hot. So that is the only failure I've seen due to cooling. But heat really does do a lot of damage. And I've had several places where, you know, the cooling has failed. And you can tell right away on the air because audio would just get all distorted as caps got hot and things like that. We'd have to shut it down. I had one situation where the room got so hot, you'd literally cinder block walls. You put your hand up on the cinder block wall and you could just feel it was just hot to the touch almost, the walls were. It got so hot in that room. But we do, you know, just like, you know, stations in New York and a lot of other large markets do. You know, we have our backups, you know, on site, but we also have auxiliary sites that have plenty of cooling and are a completely different grid and that sort of thing that can provide a sufficient signal. Because, you know, very easily, you know, generators can fail and air conditioning units can fail and, you know, when an AC unit fails in a building where you really don't have a sufficient airflow and it's a very hot day or whatever, that can happen. And you really don't have anything else you can do. You know, if it's an unseasonably hot day and your air conditioning fails and you have no, you know, real good airflow in the building, there's a good chance you're not going to be able to run your transmitters there. So you're going to have to do something offsite or run it at a lower power or bring in lots of fans or, you know, whatever. So, yeah, you know, in the Midwest, it's heat because we don't get a lot of, you know, we may only have 2 weeks a year where it gets above 90. But, you know, so we really don't design for anything hotter than that. But, you know, every once in a while, we'll get a day where it's 105 or something. And that site without the air conditioning, I have to reduce power because the heat just is, you know, I just can't move the air fast enough.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, someone asked, well, where's all this heat come from? Well, at a transmitter site, we're generating RF, radio frequency power. And of course, that RF may be in the AM band, or it may be in the FM band, or it may be in one of the several TV bands of low or high VHF or a UHF band. In any case, we're turning AC power into RF power that's modulated the way we want it to be, as we've talked about on our modulation series. In doing that, though, unfortunately, the parts that we use, whether they're transistors or tubes or MOSFETs, these are not 100% efficient, especially not the higher and higher you go up in frequency. They often become less and less efficient at higher frequencies. Or if it's an amplifier design that needs to be very linear, as Tom Ray referred to a few minutes ago, a linear amplifier will be very inefficient. It'll throw off a lot of heat and power and waste amplifying something in a linear fashion, whereas a nonlinear amplifier, like we're able to use with FM transmission, for example, with analog FM, those are a lot more efficient and will throw off less heat for the same amount of power given off. As we move into the digital era, where we have to have a lot of what we call headroom, that is, we have to be prepared for a whole bunch of ones coming along at the same time and a bunch of carriers being on in a digital spectrum, then we can also throw off a lot of heat from a digital transmitter. They're oftentimes less efficient because of the modulation scheme we have to do. I'm sorry, who was wanting to chime in?
Oh, I was. In fact, you just covered it, where I was going to say, you know, now in the world of HD, where we are using transmitters that are very linear, you know, places where we didn't really think about heat load before, we're now having to factor that in. You know, as we convert to HD radio on some of this stuff, we are going to have to worry about heat load and you know, the heat that's generated. And you brought something up early on, and I think that's I want to reiterate that because that's important, especially if you're in charge of engineering in climates where it can, you know, get very cold to very hot, and you may not plan for a whole lot of air conditioning because you generally wouldn't need it. Be sure that your transmitter is tuned correctly, you know, and it's running at peak efficiency because it'll run much cooler. The other thing is, if you know that hot water, you know, you got hot weather coming, turn off equipment you're not going to use. You know, if you're not in the building, you're not going to use that modulation monitor. You're not looking at it. So turn it off. If you have other non-critical monitoring equipment in the plant, turn it off. It's a good idea anyway, just to save electricity. But, anything you can do to shed some load and shed some heat in that building, you know, might get you through that one day that all of a sudden is just hotter than, you know, you ever remember. And it may be the difference between being on the air or not being on the air.
Do you ever have a manager ask you if we could save some money by turning those tower lights off?
Yeah. Yes, I have. I also had one ask me one day why we can't just turn the transmitter power down after 6 p.m.
Well, I guess you could, but if you want to cover 37 states or however many you do.
Well, no. But in the FCC regulations, you're allowed plus 5% to minus 10%. He was talking minus, bring it down to 25%.
Well, there you go. That's true. Now, maybe he started at a station, you know, there are AM stations, of course, that do have to reduce their power during critical hours or overnight, or go off the air altogether. That's quite a savings.
Oh, you bet. But you had mentioned before, I was reading one of your comments here. It says, unless somebody has a summer engineering comment, well, I like to talk about tools. One of my favorite tools out in the swamp in the summer is a scanner, because the mosquitoes out in the swamps in New Jersey radio into Newark before they land, so we know when they're coming. And they usually go into runway 22 left, so we're all set.
All right. And with that, can we get a serious comment out of Tom? I don't know. I've got a fun subject to talk about in wrapping up the show today. A lot of people who watch and listen to this podcast are amateur radio operators or ham radio enthusiasts. A lot of us here have a license. I do. I'm what I guess you'd call a no-code technician. I don't know Morse code. Haven't learned that. Passed the written test to have a technician class. And that means I can talk on a two-way radio on certain frequencies. But a lot of people listening to the show have much higher classes of amateur licenses, and they're able to do a lot more interesting things. And amateur radio operators get together once a year to do something that's called Field Day. Yours truly has never, ever participated in a Field Day, and I feel so embarrassed about that. Maybe I'll get around to doing that. I know they have a great one here in Nashville. Tom Ray, you're very involved with your local ham club, and maybe you can talk to us about what Field Day school is. Tell us what Field Day is about and when it's coming up.
Well, at its essence, Field Day is a day to get out and operate. Probably the best phrase I can come up with is under duress. What you do is you go out. You don't operate from your home base. You go out, and in the case of our amateur radio club, the Orange County Amateur Radio Club here in the Newburgh, New York area, we go up to Cronimer Hill Park up in Newburgh, which is we chose that because it tends to be a fairly high place. We go up there. We bring wire antennas. We bring a beam antenna. We bring generators. We bring solar power. We bring battery power. And we operate for 24 hours as if we had an emergency condition and we had to go someplace to get on the air. Because very often, and we've seen this with things like Hurricane Katrina, and we've seen it actually, I think it was about 2 months ago, someplace in Ohio. I forget the area, but the phone company did a software upgrade in the switch and took every telephone down in the county, including 911 service.
It's quite a software upgrade.
Yeah. And I'm not going to comment on who probably made the software upgrade. But in a case like that, amateur radio operators step in because we can get a signal out. We had a very bad snowstorm here in the Hudson Valley this past winter. We operated on generator here at the house for 92 hours. And at one point, we lost the cell phones and we lost the landline phones. And I knew I could get a signal out of here, whether it be on 2 meters to a local repeater or whether it was on 80 meters or on 40 meters. I could contact somebody, God forbid we had an emergency, and say, look, call the cops, call an ambulance, call whatever. And that's what Field Day is all about. But it's also a lot of fun. You get to go out. We go out. We bring the barbecue. We sit there. We bring tents. I don't stay overnight because of my back. Sleeping on the ground just doesn't agree with it. But a lot of our club members spend the night there. They operate overnight. We do things like we tune the flagpole for the 40-meter band.
Excuse me? You tune the flagpole?
Yes, there's a flagpole in the park. It's about 45 feet high. We run a
Wait a minute. Is that a euphemism for something? Where's Tom?
No, I'm being totally serious.
Excuse me while I tune my flagpole.
But we had a lot of skeptical people when we did that the first year, and we have a guy in the club. He likes running what's called QRP, and that stands for low power, which means 5 watts or less. The flagpole actually tunes up very nicely on the 40-meter band, which is 7,200 kilohertz. And his first contact with 5 watts from Newburgh, New York, was Hawaii. So through the flagpole.
Wow.
And we just go up and we just have a good time. And depending on band conditions, last year I tend to like running 20 meters. Last year I did so-so. The year before, I called CQ, and CQ is a ham radio term, meaning I'm looking for somebody to talk to. Would you please answer me? I called CQ a couple of times, and I got deluged. I think in 2 hours, I made 350 contacts. So,
from the flagpole or from some other antennas on your hill?
No, this was the 20-meter beam antenna, which I had aimed dead center across the country. And, of course, I started by accidentally aiming it towards Ireland, so I had all these Irish stations trying to call me.
So you guys bring tents, barbecue, generators, backup batteries. You got a way to distribute 12-volt power among various transceivers, whether it's a HF, shortwave, high-frequency transceiver, or a 2-meter 440 transceiver.
It's just about any transceiver you can imagine, and we have... one of our club members has an actual solar trailer. It's a trailer with solar cells and a bunch of batteries, and it'll run, when the sun goes down, this time of year, sun goes down about 8 o'clock, 8:30. We will generally run on that with four transceivers overnight until, 6 in the morning when the sun comes up again.
Okay, so this is an all-day and all-night thing?
It's a 24 hours. Starts Saturday at 2 p.m. And Sunday at 2 p.m. That's Eastern time. And you just get on and try and make as many contacts as you can. And the most important thing is to have a good time.
Now, there's a question in the chat room. 20 meters is about what frequency? Is that around 15 megahertz?
No, that's 14 megahertz. Between 14 meg and 14.350.
Okay, that's still very confusing to me to talk about frequency bands in terms of meters. And ham radio operators do this all the time because it has to do with the length of the antenna, and it's a band that's approximately that many that long of a wavelength.
Right, once you start doing it enough, you start learning. 20 meters is 14 meg, 40 meters is 7 meg, 10 meters is 28 meg. So you get to learn what the band is and. So we use it interchangeably, very, very much the same way. I mean, a lot of us at the club, we know each other's first names, but we refer to each other by call sign because that's how we know each other.
And people who aren't in that field of endeavor, that hobby, that enthusiasm, they don't get that. They don't.
My wife was shaking her head the other day because my ham radio license plate showed up, and I've now got my call sign W2TRR on my car. So she just, whatever.
It's funny. I work with, obviously, broadcast engineers. I work with a lot of hams in our company, and we'll always use, a lot of times we'll use ham shorthand as we're emailing back and forth. Like they'll say, hey, don't forget that we have a conference call, Monday at 3, and I'll write QSL and reply back. QSL meaning, message received. And, so we'll do that shorthand back and forth. The thing about Field Day with me is Field Day has been cursed. I love Field Day, and we have a great site. We have a great bunch of guys who do it. But it never fails. Something happens where I can't go. 3 years ago, my daughter was born around Field Day. This weekend, my brother has the gall to get married without checking with me if I had other things going on. So I will be able to do it this year. I may, however, bring up my HT, my handy talkie, my 2-meter radio. I may bring it up there and try to do something, locally, from the hotel, much, I'm sure, to my wife's dismay. But Field Day is a lot of fun, and especially you get to hang out with, it's the fellowship, I think, is one of the bigger parts of all of this, not only together, but, over the air with different hams. And also it's a big weekend for introducing people to ham radio. I know we go out of our way to invite anybody in the community to come by, and let them talk on the radio. You know, we'll sit there and operate the radio for them and let them make a contact with somebody else far away. And a lot of times that's somebody's introduction to ham radio, and that's where they catch the bug.
Sure. And not a bad idea to invite your local legislators, mayor, people who run the hospital or the other emergency services. So they know that in time of emergency, it can be a ham radio operator who can get a message through, who can coordinate something that when the phones are down and maybe even a tower takes down the city's two-way system for the police and fire to talk to each other. Ham radio operators are there to save the day.
Well, you want the mayor to show up because that's 100 points.
Well, that's 100 points.
You get 100 points if the mayor shows up.
And do you get any points, Tom, for mentioning something about your organization? Or have you already done that?
Yes, matter of fact, in the media, and I would consider this the media, and we're going to be talking about this on the WR Morning Show also on Saturday morning, we get 100 points for getting a media hit and bringing attention to the fact that it is Amateur Radio Field Day this weekend.
Gotcha. Well, guys, we have drawn to the conclusion of another This Week in Radio Tech, and as these free-for-alls always are, they're fun. We pick a few topics. We end up getting off on other tangential topics. Appreciate the comments from the chat room as well. We did pick up a few of those and try to answer a couple questions and use them as fodder for talk. Hey, let's run around, and each of us, you can give out either a Twitter or someplace where you'd like to be contacted or a website that you run. Chris Tarr, you got some geek Jedi-ness going on. Where can people find you?
You can just find me on my website at thegeekjedi.com, and it has all the links to Twitter and Facebook and all my different sites.
There's a the in front of that, thegeekjedi.com,
You can do geekjedi.com or thegeekjedi.com. Both will work.
How convenient. That's just great. Appreciate it. Chris Tobin, you live a private and solitary life there in Manhattan, don't you?
Yeah, just, see Tobin at cbs.com if you have any questions. That's fine for now. And maybe in the future you'll see some stuff coming along, but not right now.
All right, good deal. And Tom Ray, where can the mass public reach you in your lair of ham radio-ness?
Well, they can find me either at Tom Ray, that's T-O-M-R-A-Y, it's all one word, at WOR710.com, or W2TRR at W2TRR.com, which is a ham radio website that is a work in progress, and it hasn't been progressing very much lately, so...
Okay. Well, I'm sure you'll have some more pictures for us after your field day. And as for me, you can follow me on Twitter at kharnack. That's K-H-A-R-N-A-C-K. Kharnack. That's at kharnack on Twitter. So we're glad to look for you there. Hey, This Week in Radio Tech, you can download that from the website directly, thisweekinradiotech.com. Or you can also subscribe to it in the iTunes store. Just do a search for Tort. Two things will appear. Pick out the one that's obviously us and subscribe to that, and you'll get it downloaded automatically each week. Hey, we're going to put a number of things in the show notes, including that open letter from the SBE. So that'll be interesting. And a few other notes from things we talked about on this show. So thank you very much for being with us. We'll look forward to talking with you next time on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.